Okay. I'm being told to start by Ricky over there. A very good evening to you. Welcome to this LSE City's public lecture. This is, in effect, a sort of public-facing extension of the LSE's Executive Masters in Cities. Many of our colleagues are here with us this evening, so welcome to one and all. And what we're going to do this evening is to think about London 2050 and particularly the long-term planning of London in the next 30 or so years. I think it's worth saying, before I just introduce our speaker this evening, that London has gone through a remarkable period, a salutary lesson, really. After 1945, London effectively declined. All the way from 1945 till the mid-1980s, its economy declined relatively, and at some points, absolutely. Whole sectors disappeared. The population fell from 8.5 million to 6.5 million. And then from the mid-1980s onward, London's population started to grow again. Actually started, intriguingly, by a leading indicator measure, which is that underground and bus ridership started to increase again, actually before the population started to increase. And that was a predictor which by the late 1980s had led to the commissioning by Mrs. Thatcher's government. Mrs. Thatcher was not known for her love of public transport, it must be said, but she commissioned, or her government commissioned, the Central London Rail Study in 1989, which slowly but over time led to the construction of a number of extensions to the existing public transport system, including extensions of the underground to Heathrow, more than one of them actually now, Heathrow Express, the express line to Heathrow, and more importantly, the Jubilee line, the extension of the Jubilee line, Crossrail, which will open finally next year, at least the beginning of it, and even outlining the beginning of what is now called Crossrail 2, what was then called the Chelsea-Hackney line. All of this was in the Central London Rail Study, indicative evidence, lest we need it, that plans can matter, thinking ahead can matter. Now, having said all of that, London has grown very substantially in this period. Population's gone from the 6.6 million back to 8.6 million and beyond, even though Crossrail has not yet opened. So that is another opportunity to go further. So all I'd say, just saying that by way of introduction, is that there has been a remarkable turnaround in London's fortunes in that period. Other cities have enjoyed similar return to fortune. Others have continued to decline. Others elsewhere in the world grow in a very different way. But there is, I think we now understand, a need for planning. And since the recreation of London-wide government in 2000, we've had a London plan, a series of transport plans, and so on. Latterly, it's fair to say that as the city has grown this fast, housing has popped up, perhaps not as planned until recently, as a major need now in a city growing as fast as it has. So what I'd say, standing back from this before I just introduce Isabel, is that I think in a city with this many people living in such close proximity, at any point there is a need to think long and hard about what is likely to happen. Can't predict exactly what will happen, what infrastructure is needed, what social and governmental systems need to do to respond as we go along. Now, Isabel Dedring, who is global transport leader at ARUP, a major engineering and other type consultancy, based all over the world, was previously deputy mayor for transport and deputy chair of Transport for London, so has an incredible insight into these issues, having worked actually under successive mayors of different parties in different roles, having previously worked in Ken Livingstone's regime, then went on to work in Boris Johnson's regime, and now back in the private sector. So what Isabel's going to do this evening is to talk about London, looking ahead, but also to bring some of the benefits of having worked in practice in government to the more theoretical world of planning a great city. Ladies and gentlemen, Isabel Dedring.
Thank you so much, Tony. That's lovely and great to see so many people here. It's such a huge topic. So what I thought I would do is just talk about 10 principles or thoughts that I have on the subject of long-term infrastructure planning in the London context primarily, but also looking at other cities, especially now in my role at AIRUP. You go around and you see lots of different cities around the world. Obviously, everybody's unique and special and different, and as it turns out, it's all sort of the same thing everywhere you go. And I think when you've worked on infrastructure and planning in the real world, there's some things about, you know, how we go about doing planning that probably would benefit from some real-world experience. So what I've tried to do is just draw out sort of 10 lessons or thoughts that I've got on the subject, which are not comprehensive in any way. I'm sure your favorite subject will not be on here. When I used to work at City Hall, every time I spoke anywhere, people would say, what about the river? So I learned to always talk about the river. You know, but then, of course, there's another topic that you haven't thought of that people are really into and want to hear about. So in the Q&A, we can talk about all your favorite topics, including the river, which isn't in here. And you can keep track a bit by, I've hopefully numbered these in order. So the first point is that when you talk about infrastructure and you talk about long-term planning, because of all this sort of smart city stuff, because that really explains smart cities, you understand it now that you've seen these sorts of graphics, right? They're completely incomprehensible. Nobody actually knows what a smart city is. But what people say is that we're not going to need so much infrastructure anymore, right? People are going to travel less because they're going to be video conferencing. And what we've actually seen in London, in my role at City Hall over the time that I was there, and this is continuing, is there's actually been an increase in trip making per person. So not just a growth because of population growth. And we're seeing that around the world in a lot of locations. So this notion that kind of transport infrastructure is going to sort of slowly fade out of existence or not be needed anymore isn't in fact the case. So not only will we need more broadband infrastructure, but we will need a lot of the old traditional transport infrastructures. And because people are going to still be traveling, and so the gap between the amount of funding that's available to pay for infrastructure and the political will to deliver infrastructure and the need for infrastructure is going to grow ever bigger, if you want to think about it that way. So it's a really important principle that we need to kind of all understand and grasp, but this isn't kind of, that's the old world, we don't need to worry about all that Victorian engineering stuff anymore. And that's certainly far from the case. How we use that infrastructure will change very dramatically, but not the need for it. So the key thing in thinking about planning is not to talk about the infrastructure itself. This is the major mistake that everybody in my industry makes, because we all love transport, and we love, you know, gas networks, and we want to talk about these things, but most of us in here aren't normal. You know, people out there don't want to know about it. What they want to know about is, how is this going to help me get a job, my kid get a home? Is this going to give me better access to, you know, parts of the city that I want to travel to? And as an industry, infrastructure is very poor at speaking that language. It's sort of a necessary evil, but if we could just get back to talking about the trains and what the axles are going to look like, that would be great. And so as a kind of community of people working on these issues, the more that we can embrace and understand that people don't care about what we are actually delivering, that's a means to an end for most people, there are exceptions, then the better we'll be off. One example is Crossrail. So in the kind of, you know, London municipal community, people love to talk about Crossrail, and it's a fantastic scheme. It's going to increase the number of seats in the peak by 10% on the railway network, so 200,000 people can travel in the peak who couldn't travel before, arguably. But actually what it really is about connecting poor communities who have poor access to jobs in the centre to the centre, and it's helping to serve the sort of beating heart of jobs in the centre of London. And so over time, Crossrail sort of learned to speak that language, and, you know, things like the impact on property values, which are starting to emerge. So this is a recent 2-year period, and you can see the impact on property values along the route. Again, that's something that people relate to, they can understand. Yes, for some people it is going to make a big difference in terms of their access to work, but it's not because of the journey itself, it's because of the access to the employment. And the stations will transform local communities as well. So this is a quite unusual scheme in infrastructure world, because it speaks this language, but most infrastructure projects don't. And then blame politics when they don't succeed. We need to embrace the fact that that is what people care about, is the outcomes that these schemes are delivering. In the case of Crossrail, the fact that 400 apprenticeships were created was a really big deal and was really well promoted, and that's the kind of narrative that people will embrace and understand. And we tried to take that further when we announced the intention to extend the Bakerloo line. It was actually starting with the outcomes. So anywhere in South London, for those of you who have been there or lived there, there is no tube network, broadly speaking. You could put the tube pretty much anywhere, and it would have a fantastic transport business case. So starting with transport as the proposition for an underground extension in South London probably isn't the right answer, because any of those places would benefit from increased connectivity because it's so poor at the moment. So we actually started looking at the routes based on where the housing uplift could be, because housing really is the number one issue in London at the moment, and how could we use this to drive redevelopment, regeneration, and housing growth along the corridor. And the corridors that were selected ultimately were the ones that had the biggest opportunity, both in housing terms, but also in terms of value capture and how we could pay for the scheme ultimately. And I'll come on to that. And just similarly, you know, this is not unusual for London. In Sydney, you could see the centre is quite built up, very low density outside the centre. And so they recently announced the intention to extend the metro to the west of Sydney, to Parramatta. And the idea is that we will drive the entire route finding and the route selection and the station locations off of where the development can happen, rather than saying, which is sort of the traditional and preferred way for transport engineers to think about things, is they find the perfect, you know, transport route with the perfect geology and the most, you know, beautiful station locations. But that isn't the right way to do it from the city's perspective. So the third point is around cost. So people talk a lot about the sort of wall of projects in infrastructure, all the things we want to do, and the fact that there isn't enough money. And somewhere floating in a cloud above that is sort of, you know, pension funds. Shouldn't they somehow come and save the day because they've got billions of dollars under management? And, you know, there's something in there, and we'll come on to that. But there is a fundamental issue that infrastructure projects are much too expensive, and there's many ways in which that cost can be reduced. And there's a bit of a sort of mythology within the infrastructure industry about things costing a lot. Now, this sounds like a boring engineering question, unless you're an engineer, in which, of course, sounds like a very interesting question. But it's fundamental, because there are a lot of infrastructure projects that don't happen because they're considered to be too expensive. Okay, well, if this metro cost $4 billion, we might be able to build it. But if it's $8 billion, we definitely can't build it. So we're not going to build the metro. And I see this all the time going around the world. Everyone's got their favorite project they've decided is too expensive. So one of the things that doesn't happen in the industry and increasingly needs to happen, and something we're doing a lot of work on where I work now, is having a kit of parts, right? So everyone wants to design a station that's unique to that community, unique to that location, and London is really expert in this. Every station is different. Every station has lots of connecting tunnels, all sorts of fabulous things, but actually it's about having a kit of parts, but that's customizable to the location, and that brings the cost down very radically for building stations, which are the biggest chunk of a metro, if you look at that just as one example. Here's a station in Copenhagen with no signage, because you can see where you're going. You don't need something to tell you where the platforms are, because you stand at the top of the escalator and you know where the platforms are. And as my colleague Neela, who designed this metro, says, you can also avoid the people that you don't want to talk to, because you can actually see where everyone is. You know, you're going to have to awkwardly, like, kind of turn around and walk out the other exit. You can avoid that problem here as well. But that's another cost reduction. It's small, but it makes a difference. And these aren't just about paying less for metros. It's about making metros that are more likely to be delivered because they're more affordable. Similarly, digging a box rather than digging lots of tunnels, everybody can understand that's probably going to be cheaper and easier. And in fact, rather than having ventilation systems along the line of route, which typically are about 10 to 15% of the cost of a metro, you can actually have the roof of the station be the ventilation system. So you've immediately gotten rid of that extra cost within the metro scheme. So it's that kind of thinking that typically happens very downstream when you talk about transport infrastructure and other infrastructure projects as well. You have people who are quantity surveyors, they come in and salami slice the costs. It's actually bringing that thinking up front and saying, if we thought in this way, which we might not feel super comfortable with because it's not in line with what we've traditionally done in XYZ metro agency, this is the kind of difference it can make to affordability. And there is not the emphasis on this in the industry that there needs to be, and there's an interesting question around how planners can help to drive that, because planners can either drive this sort of approach, or they can potentially, you know, also say, well, we need a totally unique bespoke solution in this location. And that links to how we pay for things. So, you know, the traditional way that we would think of in this city in recent decades is that government should pay for everything and then everyone else benefits. We benefit as users, landowners benefit. If your house is near a metro station within 500 meters, experience around the world shows on average the value of those properties goes up by 10%. So windfall to you, that's great. God forbid you should have to pay anything towards it. And you know, Crossrail started to tap into that by thinking about ways in which people could help to pay. But of course, these aren't really new ways, because if you think about the development of the underground system 150 years ago, it was about building homes on the outskirts of London and actually using the metro and the homes as a single business case, a single business proposition. So, you know, it's back to the future on infrastructure. And just to give one example, this is a site out in East London called Barking Riverside. So it's on the north side of the river, as you can see. It's supposed to take about 11,500 homes. And obviously, we've got a housing crisis in this city. But this site was built out to about 1,500 homes, and then all the development stopped. And the reason was that it's really hard to get to, and you have to take the DLR and then a bus, and, you know, eventually it's lunchtime and you get there. So the idea was, you know, obviously the development's not going to happen. The 10,000 homes we still need there aren't going to happen unless we improve the quality of transport. But of course, for the transport agency, they don't care about this. You know, they've got like millions of people to carry around the city every single day. Why do they care about opening up a railway to a swamp so that somebody, you know, in 10 years' time can build some houses? So there's just a fundamental lack of commonality of interest there. Although everybody agrees that something should happen to tackle the issue, it's not in anyone's interest really to tackle it, or put another way, the transport agency wouldn't benefit from making the investment. And so in that case, the overground's been extended, or is being extended, to that location, which creates a rapid transit connection into the center of the city and really connects that community much better. And as a result, that development is now going forward. And, you know, what's happened in that case is that the borough has put in some funding, the developers put in some funding, the National Transit Agency, the TfL, and government at the Treasury level has put some money in. So it's been a sort of mutual interest in putting a package together where each individual party didn't have enough of an interest in doing something about it. But that's quite an unusual way of doing business, but that is the way of doing business that we need to move towards. And that requires a different skill set in our industry that doesn't really exist at the moment. And I'll talk a bit more about that later. That's the Barking Riverside development. Very nice family homes for very low price. So the fifth thing I was going to talk about was the roads opportunity. So you don't have to live in LA to know that roads are, you know, a massive blight on the city for most people, unless you're a highways engineer. I work with some of them. They think it's great. But in LA, this is taking up, you know, obviously blighting the city, taking up huge amounts of space. But in London, roads are 80% of our public space in the city. So the fact that they're just allowed to be there doing sort of some pretty low value stuff is probably, you know, not the right answer for the city. And within the whole infrastructure industry and the whole kind of industry that thinks about long-term planning and cities, we don't think about roads. We think about railways. We talk about linking railways to development. We talk about TOD. We talk about how we can kind of do value capture along railway corridors. Who talks about this in the roads context? But roads are carrying in London about 80% of the movement every day, if you count in walking, cycling, et cetera. So they're super important. They perform an important transport function, but they're also performing an important public space function. So in my view, this is an area that really needs much more scrutiny, attention, and creativity. So this is the A13 in East London. And just to give you one example, obviously very unattractive, air pollution, blight, and creates severance in a very underprivileged community. And so we've been working on a proposal to put it underground and to build anywhere between 5 and 10,000 homes on top of where the road used to be. So the idea is that there's basically low-value land next to the road, and you build the road next to the existing A13 and then deck the whole thing over, build homes on top. So, you know, amazingly enough, this scheme is actually still alive and moving on, partly because of the fantastic political leadership in that community, which I'll come on to as well. But it's just to park in your minds that, you know, there isn't any reason why the kinds of thinking that we're doing as a community on railways shouldn't be applied to the road environment. And it's just sort of the poor cousin of railways. And there's a lot of other examples of other forms of infrastructure where that same problem applies. So the sixth point I was going to make was around flexibility and adaptability. So obviously all of infrastructure is about, you know, if you could build something for 100 years, that's really great. But if you could build it for 200 or 500 years, that would be like obviously way better. And the less it's going to change, the better. And this is a bridge that Thomas Telford designed in the north of England. So, you know, where we need to get to though, is because the world's becoming a little bit more unpredictable, things are changing more frequently, we need to get infrastructure people into a place where they can design flexible infrastructure. So this is a cycle lane in Camden on Royal College Street, which I wasn't involved with, but is a fantastic scheme. And, you know, so you just put some planters in, and then that creates the dedicated space. It isn't about the highly, arguably over-engineered cycle superhighways. And you can test things out, and if they work, you can say to people, we're not going to put in a cycle lane here unless we get enough usage. And if we don't get the usage, we'll take it out again. And there's no reason why we can't be thinking fundamentally when we think about infrastructure about ways in which we can create flexible usage of that space. But that isn't the way the industry works at the moment, and it doesn't really like to work in that way. This is Times Square in New York. So, you know, there's lots of purposes to which infrastructure can be put, which it wasn't necessarily intended for. This is, I think, the summer solstice yoga event, where this is one of the major traffic interchanges in New York, which is dedicated to people doing yoga once a year. But it can also be small examples, which, again, infrastructure planning is quite difficult. People working in that space struggle to think in this sort of way. This is a little space outside London Bridge Station where we took two parking bays and we turned it into a sort of public space and a garden. And trying to get that done was almost as hard as building Crossrail. So, you know, this isn't a kind of way in which this industry likes to think about things, but increasingly that is what we need to do. If you think about railway stations, the fact that tickets are a thing of the past is just a matter of time before we don't have any tickets anymore, and you don't need contactless either. There's sensor technology that already exists that can read your mobile phone and will know that you've come through that station and will charge you accordingly. So you don't need ticket barriers, unless you would like to have them. You don't necessarily need big station halls where you read the departure boards. It's all going to be on your phone. So what is a railway station? Is it just a hole in the ground where you walk down a set of stairs and go onto the platform? Or is it a shopping mall, which is King's Cross? And actually, King's Cross, more than two-thirds of the footfall in King's Cross is not for people using transport. They're there to visit the restaurants, go to the shops, et cetera. So what is the railway station in the future, and how do we design railway stations that isn't about designing something for 50 years ago or even trying to predict what 150 years from now looks like? It's actually about designing something that can develop and evolve over time. And again, that isn't the way the sort of infrastructure community thinks about things. It isn't the way that engineers like to think about things. But that is going to have to change and evolve. What's that? It's all sort of the broader thing. It's so integrated. Yes, that's very true. Thank you. So embracing politics. Whenever you talk to people in infrastructure, they say, you know, it would all be so great if only there weren't any politicians. And we need certainty. What we need is political certainty. And, you know, that isn't going to happen. You're not going to get it. And everywhere I go, in my job now, when I go around the world and people kind of go, you don't understand as well, the politics in my city are so terrible. We can't do anything. We have three layers of government. Nobody gets along with each other. And I always sort of put up something like this slide, which is London politics. So that's, you know, kind of the boroughs, the London Assembly, the wards, and the MPs. So, you know, that's just four different lenses on London politics. So it isn't straightforward in London. It isn't straightforward in Sydney or Los Angeles or anywhere else. But that's a bit of a sort of red herring. You know, no place has clear-cut political structures, apart from sort of, you know, Donald Trump's dreamland or perhaps more repressive regimes even than that. But that isn't, that's sort of on the surface of how we get things to happen. And from my experience in City Hall, this isn't how things happen, and the mayor is in charge, and then everybody goes, yes, whatever you say. No matter where you are in the world, that isn't the way things happen. The other thing that people talk about, is ribbon cutting. You know, politicians want to cut ribbons. That is couldn't be further from the truth in my experience. No politician is going to announce a big infrastructure scheme and be the guy to cut the ribbon, because his term will be, like, long over. So the only thing you know when you announce the Bakerloo Line extension is that the next mayor or the mayor after that is the guy who's going to be cutting the ribbon. So that isn't right, but politicians do like announcements. So it's thinking about, you know, what makes politics move forward? What makes politicians back something and push it? And if they do that, then infrastructure projects can happen, whether that's a, you know, increase in electricity supply points for electric vehicles, whether that's a new metro line, whether that's cycle lanes. And this is a project that I was heavily involved with at City Hall. This was about improving tube performance over a couple of years. We increased we reduced delays by 40% roughly over 3 years. This was politically hugely successful. People really liked it. It turned around the perception of the fact that Boris just couldn't do anything on transport, so somewhat. But, you know, this had nothing to do with infrastructure. It was all about reducing delay for individuals who are using the tube every day. So there are other ways to tap into politics which aren't about ribbon-cutting and creating infrastructure. Crossrail 2, why did the mayor push that when Boris was in office? Because everyone kept saying to him, Ken had Crossrail 1, and he made Crossrail 1 happen. So why don't you have, you know, something similarly exciting to do? So there it was just sort of envy, competitiveness, and that was the thing that drove Crossrail 2 being pushed by the previous administration. And that's fine. You know, let's just tap into the basest human instincts if that's going to help us build infrastructure. This project we talked about earlier, the Bakerloo Line extension, the way that came about, for a couple of years we'd been talking about, why can't we extend the Bakerloo Line? Obviously, you know, South London, we need to do something about it. Nobody really wanted to do it at TfL. And then the mayor was going to MIPIM, which is a big property conference in the south of France, and politicians don't go anywhere unless they're making an announcement. So it can be anything, but you have to make an announcement, otherwise you can't justify the fact that you flew down there. And so he just stood up and said, we're going to extend the Bakerloo Line by 2030. Made up the date. Pretty okay date. And that's how this project came about and was sort of really initiated and pushed forward. It's now in the second round of consultation, seems to be moving ahead. It's politically quite aligned with the new mayor. So that's fine. If that's the way that project came about, it's a decent infrastructure project, we should just kind of be okay with that and actually find opportunities as a community of people interested in getting the city to move forward to tap into what, you know, the reality of politics is. A huge gap in this industry is the lack of deal makers, negotiators, people who understand how to bring parties together and build alliances. And I'll just explain really briefly through one example what I mean by that, and probably some of the examples we've given sort of touch on that already. So obviously this is Battersea and Nine Elms. The red square is Westminster, and the red line is the opportunity area, which was defined in the London plan that still exists, that's being updated by the new mayor. So I think there were four successive developers who bought this property. It went bust. Somebody else bought it, went bust again. And again, like that Barking Riverside example, nobody really had an interest in building the transport network out. So everyone said, oh, nice piece of land, very central. It's 15-minute walking distance to Westminster. But for some reason, it's not really commercially viable. And the developers who bought it most recently, who still own it now, said, well, what we need is better transport. Again, transit agency said, we don't have the money for that. And the answer was extending the Northern Line, which is a £1.25 billion project. And the way that's been paid for is through the development that's happening on the site and through the uplift in what's called business rates in that area. So it's an enterprise zone that ring fences the business rates in the area, and any uplift in the business rates that comes about because of the development is then hypothecated to pay for the transport infrastructure. But the point is that this didn't happen because the mayor said so. It didn't happen because, you know, it was in a planning document. It happened because a group of people came together and figured out how to get this commercial deal to happen, which was quite complex, required a lot of discussion of risk and who took what risk, because if that property uplift doesn't happen, or, you know, it gets built out, but the values in London don't go up at the rate that we expect them to go up because of something like Brexit, for example, then that risk is taken by partially by City Hall and partially by central government. And how we negotiated that was quite convoluted, required hundreds of hours of people's time, and needed people to lead that. And in the transport industry, in infrastructure generally, the people that can do that kind of deal are probably, you could count on one hand. So it's a huge gap, and how we close that gap, I don't know, but it's not a problem that's unique to the UK. And part of this is about building alliances as well. So, and that's not always with the obvious people. So those sort of individuals that can kind of integrate and pull people together, in the case of the cycle superhighways, which were very controversial, probably by far, I would say, the most controversial thing I was involved in when I was at City Hall, we had a very unlikely group of people who kind of were in support of building these, whatever you might think of them. That did work ultimately over time. And a lot of them were people who were supposedly the mayor's enemies, who would sort of on the face of it be shouting at him, saying, you know, you're not doing enough, whether it's about air quality or cycling. And it was about building those alliances behind the scenes, because they would understand that they needed to be seen to be attacking the mayor, but behind the scenes were very keen to support the creation of something like this. So thinking creatively about who are the people who actually want to get something to happen is very important and can help bridge this political cycle uncertainty, which people talk about a lot. But if you've got the right alliance behind the scenes, it doesn't matter who the mayor is, it'll probably happen, 90-95% likelihood, in the new regime as well. So how we engage with the public on infrastructure probably couldn't be worse, I would say. And, you know, the digital era creates new opportunities in this regard. And it isn't just about, you know, here's a brilliant thing that we want to do, and then we'll just bolt on some community relations and a bit of press release stuff. And that's the way sort of most infrastructure projects think about engagement with the public. And that's why a lot of projects do stumble politically or in the public's eye. So one project I was involved with at City Hall was the redesign of Elephant and Castle roundabout, which is one of the accident black spots in London, but also happens to be not a very attractive place, and there's a big redevelopment going on in that area as well, so there was an opportunity to redesign that. And this isn't a bit of paper we had there, but this is pretty standard for when you're in a political role, whether that's a senior person at a transport agency or more junior person or a politician, and you go out to the community and you say, I've got a brilliant idea, we're going to take this roundabout, we're going to make it amazing, here it is. And most people cannot read this, but it certainly looks pretty, you know, uninteresting, and definitely doesn't bring out the best in the scheme. And if you're lucky, you might get something like that. That was sort of like at the highest standard of what we could do from an engagement perspective. So literally, this is what you have in your hand when you go out to convince hundreds of people in an angry town hall meeting that this is really what they want in their community. And clearly, this is not the way anybody should be approaching infrastructure design. You know, it needs to be a lot more like this, which is like, if you wanted to do something in this area, what would you like to do? And obviously, it's quite old school. I think it's pipe cleaners and blocks. But, you know, it's talking to people about, from first principles, what they would like to have in that community. This is the absolute exception. I would say in less than 5% of infrastructure projects use this kind of technique to approach the whole question of binding in the public at an early stage in the process, and sort of involving them in these sorts of diagrams at a very early stage, rather than just hiving it off to an architecture firm, for example. It's about actually having the public there with you right from the very start. And this is the scheme, if only the world really looked the way these pictures always look, but I'm sure it looks exactly like this right at this very moment. But, you know, that's the scheme ultimately that was delivered, and it went in with, like, very, very little opposition in that location. So it's just an example of how you can do these things differently. And, you know, just in a similar vein, Arup's got something called the Sound Lab that we've used with HS2. And it, actually, when people are worried about, you know, the high-speed 2 is going to come past my house, what's it going to be like? Sounds like it'll be really noisy. It can actually show you exactly what it is going to be like, rather than just saying it's going to be fine or I have an expert who said it was okay. It's actually putting people into an environment where they can hear it for themselves. And those are very simple concepts, but they're very rarely deployed in the world of infrastructure, and that, in my view, is why a lot of projects fail at the first hurdle. Obviously, this is the appropriate point in the presentation to have a Minecraft pig. But when you think about the tools that are available in gaming today, and that you can kind of, you know, pick up blocks and move blocks around, you could design a little shed for your pig, and the pig will stay in the shed, and you can, you know, break apart the shed, and the pig will walk away. When we talk to people about how we're going to redesign their roundabout or what we want to do with the cycle superhighway, we cannot give them anything interactive of that description. There is no such thing out there. There are no tools that exist that really do that. We can do static pictures of what it's going to look like, or we can do moving pictures, but it's a static scheme. What you can't do is say, well, I don't understand. Why does that curb line need to be there? Or why does that light need to be like that, and why can't I move it around? In a gaming environment, we could do that, and Minecraft is certainly a very low-tech version of that. So there's a big challenge, I think, for the transport industry in thinking about digital and how we can kind of create tools that are helpful for strategic decision-making, helpful for engagement. Clearly, the kind of technologies exist to do that, but we simply have never deployed them into this environment because this problem isn't fully recognized to the extent that I think it needs to be. And the last point I was going to make was around delighting people. So, you know, when you think about something like Crossrail, it is incredible that we're digging this huge tunnel underneath London. And people want to love it, and they want to be delighted by it. And whilst I said earlier that people don't care about the infrastructure, we need to be trying harder to get people engaged with the sort of joy of what is happening when we are developing a city and building a city. And Crossrail's been really good at this. In Copenhagen, for example, they built platforms so that when they were building the metro, you can actually see what's happening. Like, why are the hoardings up so you can't see it? Let people actually enjoy the interest of, you know, what the digger looks like and what the drills look like. The process of naming the tunnel boring machines under Crossrail. You know, millions of people wrote in with their ideas about name suggestions. It's a way of getting people excited and enthused about something that they naturally kind of are suspicious of, but maybe want to get quite enthusiastic about. The archaeological program that Crossrail ran was hugely popular. There's a big exhibition now at the Museum of London. And just the last example I was going to give you was from the Copenhagen Metro, where the skylights were designed to cast rainbow patterns on the escalators at certain times of year, but they didn't tell anyone they were going to do it. And then when it started happening, people were so, you know, so in love with this idea. And that was a really simple intervention that cost nothing. It was just about how the skylight was designed, and that really got people enthused and excited about this new piece of infrastructure in quite a different way. And I do think it's an important point for the industry, because there's a bit of a kind of, you know, ooh, I'm going to build a thing, and I know you're not going to like it, but, you know, let me tell you why it's going to be okay. And, you know, there's this sort of defensiveness that a lot of the industry has about building any kind of infrastructure, because they know people are going to think about roadworks, they're going to think about disruption, but actually telling the other side of that story is really important, too. I'll leave it there, and we can do the Q&A. Thanks very much.
Okay, very good, excellent, and the more so for the excellent signposting through the, you know, 10 points.
So you know, in case you get fall asleep.
Exactly.
And you know, can come back and you know where you are.
Going. Yeah. Right.
Perfect.
Now, Isabel, you were deputy mayor and deputy chair of deputy mayor for transport and deputy chair of transport for London. And clearly what you've described tonight are some of the things that you have presumably picked up in that role. But what did you find on a day-to-day basis were the most difficult things to drive through? You knew what you wanted to do, what the city needed. What was it? What were the things that stopped you? What kind of intervened to make it difficult?
I think there's a surprising level of status quoism and a molasses-like quality to a lot of large public institutions, which is not really based on anything particularly apart from long-term experience and a sort of ongoing reconfirmation that we're doing the right thing. And that sort of sense of inertia, especially in the public sector, where you think people are there to make the world a better place, that's why they went into public service, not into making trainers, it takes you back, and it's quite frustrating at times. I think the other thing is that politics is not, you know, even if you're not a politician, all of this stuff happens in a political environment. And in a political environment, things do not happen in a linear way. So if you come from a background like most of us, which is analytical, whether you're a lawyer, engineer, planner, whatever it might be, you think that if the pie chart says, you know, 40% of carbon emissions come from the existing home stock, and that's by far the biggest source of carbon emissions in the city, everyone would go, right, okay, that's the thing we should tackle. What can we do about it? That isn't the way it works. It's just about, you know, these sort of, liken it to surfing. You know, it's kind of, there are these moments in politics when you have to be ready for them, but unfortunately you can try and create them, but you can't always create them.
And is there a paradox in this, in that I always think with TfL, and you know, sometimes TfL's greatest fan, not always. I mean, TfL has to have executive authority to do a fair number of the things it has to do. You mentioned the cycle superhighway, but even introducing the bike system, you require a fair degree of executive power to be able to do that, because otherwise the city will stop you doing everything. And yet, in having that power and authority, inevitably it tempts the very rigidity to which you've just referred, really, which is that the same people who know how to drive things through to get them done also are not always going to be very imaginative in terms of dealing with the public or dealing with the day-to-day experience of actually using the system, the point you made at the very beginning yourself.
I think the one One thing you discover is the value of politicians and civil servants, and indeed the media and lobby groups and academic institutions, and it's that coalition of people that makes things happen. I used to always say to Peter Hendy when he was running TfL, I always said, if we were getting along really well every day, there would be a problem, because it either means you're not doing your job or I'm not doing my job. It is not the job of politicians and civil servants to agree on everything. That's why you have both politicians and civil servants. And some of the things that I did when I was at City Hall wouldn't have been possible if it weren't for this sort of vociferous attack of lobby groups. People like Simon Burkett, who have really tenaciously and systematically campaigned for air quality, have had a profound impact on the quality of policymaking in the city. And, you know, thank goodness for that, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to do some of the things that we've done on, you know, low-emission zones, the new electric taxi that's coming in, all these things. You know, that was because we were under political pressure. Most people in general in life don't do anything unless there's a sort of burning platform, like you're going to get sacked, your boss is going to shout at you, you're not going to win another term of office, you're going to be on the front page of the Evening Standard. This is my dark view of human nature. And so, you know, in politics, how do you create that burning platform? That's a key question for anything in infrastructure. And I think sometimes that's where long-term sort of planning falters, because it's like, here is the right answer. The pie chart says we should build the railway over there. Well, you know, if the political moment isn't there, then that's not where the railway's going at this point in time.
And my last question before I open it up. I mean, this is an argument, though, and the way you've put this evening is that it is an argument for what you might call this style of political executive, because traditionally in Britain there were politicians and there were civil servants, I mean, and that was about it. But the London mayor model, the one that's about to be extended to other cities, which clearly exists in many other cities, particularly in North America, but not only there, fuse at the top politics and executive power, and infusing them make it possible to do, well, question really, to do the kind of direct delivery of the city's policy in a way that would be more difficult just for non-political officers? Question.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, but I guess the only thing I would add to that is that you can have people who have that political mindset and understanding on the civil service side as well, and some of the best civil servants are people who understand how to work in partnership with political momentum and how to help create political momentum. So yes, I do think you need that, but you know, there is a real challenge around, if you think about the new city mayors that are being brought in, or going to North America, you see some mayors who don't have that team around them, and there's very limited in what they could do. So it isn't about the theory of the office. It sort of goes back to the point on politics. It's about a small group of individuals who together get it and can get things to happen.
Great. Okay. Now, any... yes, and don't feel you have to say who you are, but say if you, and a microphone will appear.
Chris already knows all these things.
Microphones upstairs as well, so I can see you over there now. Yeah.
Isabel, thanks. It's Chris Choa from AECOM. We're in a room here. We've all kind of drunk the Kool-Aid, and we kind of agree that connectivity is destiny. We think this is very important. We understand this naturally. But in a environment where people are also debating the differences between solidarity and diversity, between closed and open systems, what have you done, what do people do when you have communities that do not want to be connected? Any thoughts about that?
That's a great question. I don't have the answer to that, but I think it's a fascinating observation. And the only thing I would say is that when the Bakerloo Line extension was originally proposed, it was supposed to go down to Bromley. And Bromley are very clearly, we do not want more development. We don't want more people moving into Bromley. And part of putting in the Bakerloo Line extension meant that all the people who lived there for decades who used certain pathways to go to Cannon Street would now be able to have access to Lewisham, but they didn't want access to Lewisham. They want what they've had for the last X decades. And so in the end, we just, you know, realpolitik, why are we building this thing? It's very expensive to Bromley with no value capture, no uplift there. But it wasn't acrimonious. It was just, you know, you don't want it. There's no point. There's huge numbers of communities north of you who would like to have the line. So I'm not sure how much you can do about that, because you know, like I was saying earlier, you have to go to an extent with the grain of how things want to move, but you can create that grain. But a place like Bromley, you know, that is not where they are, and there wasn't anything, despite, you know, significant efforts on our part, there wasn't anything we could do to re-portray that. Having said that, then I think there's examples that are a little bit more in the middle territory, like the whole issue of densification and growth, not only London, but, you know, places like Los Angeles, as you know, they've got issues with, you know, the whole issue of density. You know, when you say to people, oh, we need to be a denser city and we need growth, it's like, that sounds terrible. I'm here already. Everything's fine. You know, why would you want densification? That's other people coming into your community and into your neighborhood. But I think, again, as an industry, we haven't really explained density in a way that, you know, is attractive. And I do think that you can persuade people if you describe it in a different way. If it says, you know, there's going to be a few more stories, but you're also going to get a new park, a playground, a school, and a GP surgery, well, 80% of people will be in favor of that in most locations. So to your point about the people who don't want change or don't want connectivity, I don't think we're thinking hard enough about what are the arguments that we could use that aren't about connectivity, maybe, but incidentally create connectivity. And again, the industry is quite poor. It goes back to this outcomes point. It's quite poor at articulating what those broader outcomes might be.
And probably incentives, really. I mean, incentives are often not very clear. I mean, that's the point, isn't it? The development just leads to negative consequences without people getting any of the incentives.
And when people talk about NIMBYism, you know, NIMBYs are usually right. You know, how many people building transport infrastructure are actually really thinking about, you know, okay, we're going to put a railway station here, so let's think about how we can create a public space, trees, benches, a cafe, a place to drop people off outside the station. I'm like, no, it's sort of whack in the station, cheap and cheerful. I mean, we had a lot of discussions. Ealing, I think it was Ealing Broadway, you know, Crossrail, cheapest possible station, here you go, linoleum clad, whack it in. And, you know, there was no engagement with the community of any real significance, apart from to tell them how brilliant this station was going to be. And, you know, so it doesn't take much, I think, to bind people into the concept of what it is that you're trying to deliver if you actually start by listening to what they're after, and it might just be a bench outside the station.
Okay, very good. Now, up there, yep.
I think the model that's always held out for London, and it used to drive us, obviously, every city, you know, if you say, why can't you be more like this? That's like the number one way to irritate everyone in City Hall. How many times is someone going to tell me, just do what Copenhagen did? It's so easy. And I think the challenge for big cities, like the world cities, you know, is that a lot of the examples that are held up in the urban community is about Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Bogota. They're smaller cities. So I think there's a real challenge for most big cities about how they can kind of translate that experience into a big environment. And therefore, the organism instantly rejects those things. You know, it's like, well, that's nothing to do with us. That's a city that's, you know, one-tenth the size of us. So no relevance, nothing to do with us. I would say probably the major lessons for London are around where we've done things well and actually doing that more systematically across the city. So if you think about linking housing and transport development more, you know, holistically and properly and doing it well, there's some examples of doing that, but most of the time we're not doing it. So I think it's actually, there's probably not a city that's that much better at doing X, although the smaller cities I think are that much better. And we do try and bring a lot of those lessons into a kind of larger city context. I feel like that's a bit of a rubbish answer, but that's the best thing I could think of. I'm sure there are other cities that are better than London.
There are bits of Hong Kong creeping into the discussion about developing transport now, don't you?
Yeah.
The logic of the transport development system, compulsory purchase, very high levels of development density, helping to pay for the infrastructure.
But again, I think it's that, you know, how do you translate that into the London environment? Because most cities are grappling with this issue of densification, and how do you do that in a way that is contiguous with the sort of brand of that city and the identity of that city. And the quality of thinking on this in, you know, my world is
absolutely poor. You know, it's just sort of like, oh, it's fine. You know, have a tower block, and here's some numbers showing how brilliant it is. There isn't that thinking about how can we free up space on the surface. You know, by making something taller, you can free up more surface area to do lovely things with. Or, you know, is there going to be a garden on the roof or whatever? There just isn't that thinking around the place, I think. And it's not being articulated in that way. And yes, operations, for sure. We are terrible on all the railway operation stuff. So, you know, we could definitely learn from that.
From Hong Kong. So a hand there and then a hand there.
Hey, Joe Jackson. I work for Atkins, so a little bit of your competitor. I was just interested to know, it's a buzzword at the moment, but how are you factoring the need for renewable energies into your planning? So can we expect to see like power packs like on the London streets and superchargers? And based on like Sweden's sort of recent announcements, when can we expect London to go 100% renewable in your sort of
I missed the key
estimates.
Word in your sentence. When can we expect what? Like sort of energy?
Well, sort of future. Sweden recently announced they're going, you know, 100% renewables, and London being one of the most aspirational cities in the world. I'm just interested, is there something, you know, in the mix at the moment? Is that what we're aspiring to?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I was, obviously, I'm not going to tell you, because you were for Atkins.
Okay.
So sit down. The thing that I was most, and I think that whole kind of area is obviously, we need to be doing a lot more generally across the world on it. It's sort of, hamstrung by the fact that everybody keeps talking about the next generation technologies rather than deploying the technologies that we have already. So everyone's sort of hydrogen buses, blah, blah. They cost £500,000. We can't afford hydrogen buses, but maybe if we bought 10,000 of them, the price would come down. But so far, nobody's been prepared to do that deal. So what we need to do is actually roll out electric vehicles, for example, which exist, work, and, you know, are deliverable. So what I focused on when I was at City Hall was trying to get the technologies that are cutting edge but commercially available or near commercial out onto the streets. And I think that's where we really all need to focus, actually, even as an advisory community on, you know, no bus should be purchased in this world today that isn't, you know, if your double-deck bus is advanced hybrid technology. There aren't electric double-decks available yet, although they're coming available. No single-decker bus should be purchased that isn't zero emission. So why is that still happening? And how can we help our clients in thinking about, you know, what are the procurement obstacles or why did they think that that technology couldn't work for them and all that kind of stuff? And I think a lot of the discussion around, you know, but do we have enough electricity supply in the cities to cater for that, just as one example, electric isn't the answer to everything, is just a bit of sort of, you know, lobbying by the electricity industry. You know, in the history of the world, every time there was a new building that needed electricity, it was fine. Eventually got the electricity generally. So, you know, if we just have loads of vehicles that need to be powered by electricity, it will just be added to the regulatory asset base and, you know, it'll be fine in the end. So I think there's a lot of sort of like noise around this topic, and actually just rolling out the technologies that exist already, to me, is the priority. If you look at the I think it's been renamed the T-Charge, the ultra-low emission zone that we propose is going to have a massive impact on the vehicle fleet in London, and actually just focusing on getting that message out there and getting people buying the kind of right kind of vehicles is probably, I think, where as an industry where we should be focused. But it is going to radically change the delivery of energy into the city. You know, so my colleague Ian, Tony and I were just talking about this. You know, he's talking about, you know, the sort of balance of what forms of energy flow into the city is going to radically shift over time. And that is a conversation that needs to be had with the electricity industry, but we've got to move them away from the whole, like, doom and gloom, you know, price review focus.
Okay.
It's too pragmatic of an answer, maybe.
I was going to say, well, certainly if somebody had said 30 years ago the city is going to grow by 2.25 million people in 30 years, I'm sure the energy industry would have said that can never be done.
Just keel over, yeah.
Right, there's one there and then one here.
Yeah. I'll just stay here because otherwise I can't at least a third of you. So.
Hi, Isabel. Thank you, Tony. I just wanted to get around the idea of trying to grapple with community engagement and specifically around short-termism politically anyway. I'm not going to cite or go on for too long about my own specific case and my local authority, but Tony came down to see us in Merton a couple of years ago, and we've got a very big regeneration forthcoming. You know, just £1 billion is going to be the cost of it. And I really have a strong concern as to how that's going to be developed or delivered with the wholehearted welcome approach from the residents. I don't think it is, as you put up on your board earlier, you had four different kinds of politics. And I'm just wondering, is there a necessity for politics anymore? Because I think that a lot of the communities can drive what they want to drive on their own.
But I see that as politics. You know, that's part of the political process. You know, politics is everything that isn't the pie chart that says you should do it. It's about the sort of series of engagements, and that's always been true. But I think it's how we tap into that phenomenon. And I think social media really creates that. But if I think about the cycling agenda, you know, lots of people don't like the cycle superhighways, but when we decided that we wanted to deliver those, that would never have happened. That whole program of work would never have happened if it weren't for community engagement in a different form, which was the community of cyclists in London who really mobilized to support that infrastructure construction. So I think the challenge for people in the kind of traditional part of politics, which is the mayor or the minister for whatever, or the leader of the borough, rather than thinking about, like, this is a bit scary because social media means that communities are more vociferous, more connected, more able to have impact maybe in some ways. I'll just bury my head in the sand and I won't even think about it. No, it's thinking about how you tap into that and how can you work with that community of people. But most people who are, you know, in the traditional political leadership roles are, you know, 50-something and older. And, you know, the easiest solution is just, you know, just forget that Twitter exists and just read the newspaper and it's all going to be fine. So it's sort of actually, to me, it's just another tool. The kind of engagement with communities and the rise of social media is another way to get infrastructure to happen, but it's about how you go about doing that. And I think there's very few examples of good practice in how people go about doing that, especially given that we can't even do the basic things like I described earlier. You know, if that's the absolute exception case to do something really basic, like getting people into a room and saying, we're going to do something, what would you like to see out of the scheme before we put pen to paper, is not a really advanced concept. But that is the exception rather than the norm.
Right.
Okay. And one here, and then one at the back. No, sorry, here first. Sorry, send us back.
Thank you. Sorry. Alan Pullman, Studio 111, Los Angeles. Thank you for showing that very becoming picture of the 4 or 5 freeway.
Alan's going to fix it all. It's going to be fine.
So I know that Arup is doing a lot of research into autonomous vehicles. And I wonder if you could give us a little bit of thought of how you see that affecting public transport and the kind of infrastructure improvements that public transport is requiring. And how does it change how we think about future public transportation?
Yeah. Well, as you said, we're doing some work on it because I'm not sure we have a good handle on it, although I'm not sure anybody's got a really good handle on it. What I will say is two things. One is that everybody's talking about driverless cars over here and we're over there, and actually it's going to be, you know, transport is the most antiquated industry in the world and, you know, obviously resists all change at all costs. So, you know, it will take several decades for us to get there. So I think the first point is, how do we actually think about that transition period and what is that and what types of autonomy or aspects of autonomy are going to come in to the vehicle fleet before that nirvana point in time? And, you know, when you think about some of those technologies are very well tested and exist, but they're not deployed on the vast majority of the vehicle fleet, which would significantly improve improve road safety very significantly. So some of the detection technologies, you know, you could buy that if you're, you know, want to spend an extra £1,000 on your Audi or whatever it is. Most people are not going to do that. So there's an interesting question about uptake and how this actually happens and how it rolls out. The other thing is, I think the automotive industry is portraying this as, you know, the answer to all the world's problems. It's going to be so lovely. You're going to sit in your car. And so there's these fantastic pictures with, like, people in cashmere sipping, you know, sort of champagne glasses. We're all going to be these people once driverless cars arrive. And actually, for me, I think the question for transport as an ecosystem of movement is, why would you ever take the train if you can, you know, easily pick up a pod that's going to sweep you to your exact destination? And what's the actual net, the kind of story that the driverless vehicle industry is telling is that this will create capacity on the road network. It will reduce congestion. But in a city like London, it will massively increase congestion to the point of gridlock, because people will switch out of bus, out of tube, into these vehicles. And we've seen that with Uber, for example, because it's a cheap, it's an affordable, not as cheap as the bus, but closer in price point than a black cab. And so where have Uber travelers come from in London is not from cars. They've come out of public transport. So I think there's a really interesting question about what is the impact of driverless vehicles on demand and capacity across the different modes. And to my mind, unless there's some serious policy interventions in an urban context, it will radically increase congestion on the road network. So we need to figure out what's that equilibrium and what is the right set of policy interventions in order to manage that, let's say.
I mean, presumably it'll have a very different effect in outer cities rather than... I mean, in outer cities, it will kill off taxis and buses, won't it? But in inner cities, it'll have exactly the effect you just described.
Yeah, so we just need to have a more kind of clear-eyed, I think, understanding of what the likely equilibrium will be, or a series of scenarios around what the equilibrium will be as a result of that, yeah.
Okay, there's a question right at the back, and then I'm going to take the one in the middle up the top there. Yep.
Hi there, Christopher Kubert from KPMG. So I'm going to stick to the typical accountant's remit and ask, how do we pay for it and funding issues? So there's been a lot of talk recently about land value capture as ways of paying for ambitious new transport schemes like the Bakerloo Line extension and Crossrail 2. I was wondering what your thoughts were on how, I guess it's a two-pronged question really. A, do you think it's politically possible to get political backing for things like targeted taxes on developers, on communities around transport infrastructure to pay for new transport infrastructure? And B, do you think it's possible that central governments will lend off the back of such income streams, given that they are quite volatile and cyclical? Yeah. I was interested in your thoughts.
Yeah. Thanks. That's I could do a whole other lecture on that, but don't worry, I'm not going to give it. It's a great topic and very poorly understood, I think, in the industry generally, because everybody, it's one of those things where, like, nobody wants to admit they don't really understand it. Someone goes, value capture, yes, very interesting. But actually, nobody really knows how Crossrail was funded and how it actually worked without getting into the nitty-gritty. I think a lot of the things you're saying are correct. My view is, having looked at a lot of these projects around the world, we're doing a piece of work at the moment, the sort of, you know, what's best practice and what's the full range of tools that you can deploy. The Northern Line Extension is an interesting example how maybe not to do it, because that project is, the funding for it is entirely, let's say, almost entirely, funded from this one income stream. So it's about what's going to happen to commercial property tax in this very narrow area, in this one city. And that's the only stream. And that's why the debate around risk allocation was so massive in that project, was because nobody wanted to have the risk, and we had to end up splitting it three ways. And there's all sorts of like ways in which the risk is backed off. So I wouldn't say that's the way that you want to think about value capture, you know. And that's at the moment, because it's a little bit of a nascent area and people are really interested in it, but they're kind of testing the waters. The typical reaction is that people say, okay, let's find this one stream or these two streams, and that's what we're going to tap into, which don't necessarily, aren't necessarily the right answer. Whereas there's projects like Transbay Terminal in San Francisco, which uses a whole series of different layers of funding streams, and that's the way to do it, because they're more difficult to negotiate. It goes back to my point around needing people who are kind of commercial and can do those deals. But Transbay, for example, has a citywide taxation element. It uses some of the tolls from the San Francisco Bay bridges. So there's that, but then there's also the oversight development, and there's the impact on the properties around the station, and there's a kind of percentage on top of the fares, if you want to think about it that way. So that way you're splitting the risk between a whole series of different funding streams, which makes a central government player more willing to take on some of the risk offtake, which is a huge issue for every big infrastructure project has that problem, but it diminishes the risk. So kind of heterogeneous, broad thinking, cast the net wide and then narrow down. And I think it's a really interesting opportunity for also people in the advisory space like us. You know, people don't understand this very well, and it's kind of, here's all the kind of weird and wonderful things you can do to pay for things. But yeah, it's the future for sure, and it is insane that we don't use it more. And actually, hundreds of years ago, people understood this way better than we do now.
And actually, two things to add to that. One is, for those who are interested in land value capture, Transport for London via the Mayor of London's website has recently published an excellent document on land value capture, which is a way of catching up on all the latest news.
Was it written by you, Tony?
What?
Was it written by you?
It wasn't written by me, but I was involved just before that with the London Finance Commission. And what's interesting about that is that land value capture was pressed on the Commission quite strongly. And the reaction of politicians of all stripe was, oh, well, it's an interesting idea in theory, but we wouldn't want anything that increased the domestic, like the household tax bill of anybody living in any actual property. So they were very, in theory, yes, and for anything new, fine, but, going to the Northern Line point, but for anybody actually living in an existing home, oh, certainly not. And that is the problem, that, you know, the logic of it is, if you make it work, it will pay for lots of stuff, as Isabel says, but, or potentially could, but it involves effectively taxing people for the uplift in the value of their home because of the arrival of the Jubilee line, let us say, and it would have gone up a lot in some places, as your figures showed. Anyway, now, the back there, yeah.
Hi, good evening. My name is Jean-Pierre. I'm from Johannesburg in South Africa. I think with the recent attacks in London and yesterday suspected attacks in St. Petersburg, security threats are at the forefront of people's minds. What sort of security solutions and innovations can the transport industry look forward to from the transport industry going forward?
That's a really good question. I mean, I don't think that the transport industry is the right place to look for innovation on that front, but I think it is a gap. Maybe you can do that after you, you know, that could be your next job, is you could solve that problem. Obviously, the rise of digital and the fact that we're kind of going to know where everybody is, I think that, you know, but that's not any more true on transport infrastructure than it is anywhere else. So I think it's a huge gap, actually. It's not something I've thought that much about, but you're right. And I think it, especially because of the rise of the sort of whole concept of ticketless transport that you kind of just show up on the bus, right? So there's a kind of control point there that's going to be lost. I was talking to somebody yesterday about it. There's a station in Tokyo that has 200 entrances, and you know that's how they manage flow in and out of the station and connect it into the community. So that would be, from an urban planning perspective, you know, that is the absolute pinnacle of urban planning in many ways. But from a security perspective, it's a nightmare. So I think thinking about that balance, it's a really interesting point. I'll think about it. Next time I see you, I'll have a better answer.
I was at a meeting yesterday where somebody suggested, and I thought all the years I've been going to events where people say we need to declutter the pavements, sidewalks, suddenly people are saying we need to have lots of obstacles on the pavements and sidewalks in many parts of the city. So a long way from where we used to be in that public policy. Yep, about there. Can you wait for the microphone just so we can all hear you?
Hi, my name's Tom. I work for the think tank ResPublica. I was wondering if you think that we think about enough about the issue of equality when we talk about transport and infrastructure. London's transport is pretty expensive if you're on a low income. And we have the new bus fare, which is all right if you're using the buses, but the buses haven't been invested in much. They're pretty slow. If you have to travel by bus to work, it adds, you know, like an hour of your day. So what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it's a really interesting topic because it's really poorly understood within, I think, in general, in urban thinking about, you know, how do you really tackle inequality? There's a lot of stuff and, you know, sort of models and conceptual diagrams. But what actually is going to have the right impact, in the same way that we do economic analysis for transport about the impact that it's going to have, and that's part of the business case, is a very robust, you know, approach. There's lots of things that need to change about it, but at least there's some, you know, well-established algorithms for thinking about that. Equality is something I did some work on ages ago, and it was amazing. The further you dig, the more vague it gets, kind of thing, and I think it's a real gap in thinking in general in the urban, you know, sort of space, but in transport in particular. So in London, rather than, you know, really solving that problem, we're just going to go, well, we'll make buses really cheap, and that way everyone who can't afford things can take the bus. So that's, I mean, it's better than nothing, but it's a very, very simplistic solution to the problem. So my own view is that the fare structure needs to be fundamentally, apart from the fact the fares are too high, the fare structure should be fundamentally reviewed to think in a more nuanced way about, you know, there's huge numbers of concessions that are given out, which politically are very difficult to then take away. But, you know, once you kind of go to low-income people from people with no jobs and children, there's just, you just go straight up to the regular fares levels, and there's really interesting analysis around people not taking jobs because actually they're better off on benefits because of the difference in transport costs. You know, so basically your sort of well-offness increases to a certain point, then it would drop, you know, with a certain level of income job, and then it goes up again. So you have to be earning quite, you know, a substantial amount per week to actually make that balance worthwhile. So it's an area that I think needs a lot more
thinking from an academic perspective, but also from a kind of policy, sort of more nuanced policymaking perspective. And there's lots that you could do around. I mean, in New York, where I grew up, they had something called transit checks. So it was basically subsidized fares for low-income people. That's one way. You know, that would be a more effective way to tackle it. I think it's underinvestigated, and definitely poorly handled in London.
And the question at the top there, microphone perhaps.
Is this all sort of like off the record? Obviously, the Thames Estuary Airport is the only answer, but that's the party line. I think it's something that the public does not care about, and my frustration with this topic in London is that it became a political football very early on, and a way for Boris to score points with government and, you know, all of that sort of stuff, Westminster Village type stuff. I think most people actually don't see it as a major issue because, you know, if I want to go somewhere, I can kind of get somewhere and then I can get back again. So clearly the business community cares, but I think it will be, and therefore I think it's quite difficult to achieve anything politically on this agenda because there isn't that burning platform and that groundswell the way there is with, say, homes or transport about we need to do something about this as a city. And therefore, I think things like T3 are very difficult to deliver because they're going to be politically, you know, the local politics of that topic is extremely toxic and difficult. It's all gone quiet recently, but it could easily kind of come back again, and I think one should expect that it will come back again. And then where is that burning platform sense from the rest of London that's saying, well, we get it, and that's why you feel that way, local community, but actually, you know, this is why we as a city really need this to happen. So it's very difficult to see how that balance will work from a political perspective.
Right.
And I'm not sure we need more aviation capacity as a city, by the way. I think, you know, it's very underutilized. The whole pricing structure is crazy. And, you know, I think there's a lot more capacity in the existing system.
Hi, I've just come back from the Global Greens Conference in Liverpool. And one of the issues people were talking about was land rights. And you said very lightly early on, and I do appreciate you're an engineer, basically, not a economist in this situation.
It's even worse. I'm a lawyer, actually.
Okay, sorry.
I apologize.
But you said, you know, so you get the new tube station and you get a windfall in your property.
Yeah.
Now, in a city like London,
yeah,
the tulipomania of property values and the money laundering is inseparable from the economic apartheid. And I just don't see, and it looks like the way we're going, it's going to get worse, you know, because that's all we're going to be. So, I mean, I know that's not your brief. Mm. It's not the same as building the tunnels. But somewhere there is a relationship. I was listening to the Merton guy, and I felt, you know, what becomes of communities if, in fact, they're pushed out in order for commuter belts?
Yeah, well, it goes back to the point around equality. And, you know, basically we're trying to bring people in from ever more distant locations because people can't afford to live in an ever increasingly expensive, you know, center of the city. So, in other words, the center is growing all the time. It's expanding outwards. And when we say regeneration, that's always like in urban world, that's a good thing, right? Because we're kind of changing communities and improving them. But it almost always means that actually it's less affordable to live in that location. And I think there's been a real, I would say across all the political cycles in London, at least, with all the mayors, there's been a void of political leadership on the question of affordability, where there's been standards set out, which are excellent, but they're not adhered to at any level of government, broadly speaking. So, you know, either we don't mean it, and we actually want to just say, okay, if you're low income, you just need to live, you know, somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Fine, that's the kind of city we want to be? Let's just be honest about that. Or if we say we want 50% affordable housing in new developments, then we should be delivering that, surely. It's not my area of expertise, but I just don't understand, you know, sort of why this has sort of taken place over time. I'm sure what I'm saying is completely my former colleagues would say I was, you know, talking total rubbish, but and I'm sure I am. But that'll be my take on it.
It's just implicit in the regeneration question.
Right, but does it need to be is the question, or what is that right, you know, how do you find that balance, or perhaps do we need to just have a more open dialogue as a city? It's kind of like, let's just push that under the carpet kind of thing, and actually saying, you know, well, if we have that level of affordable housing, then that means we can't pay for these things, and you know, that's a trade-off we need to decide as a local community, you know, but that conversation doesn't happen. So that might be a starting point to trying to unlock some of this, is sort of looking at scenarios and say, you know, we can either have, you know, the Bakerloo line with this sort of change, or we can not have the Bakerloo line and not have that sort of change, which is also a choice. And that's effectively, that's the kind of, you know, Bromley choice is, you know, we don't want to change. We don't want people to come into this neighborhood because that means that the people who are here today are going to leave. And that's okay too, you know, but there isn't a kind of open debate about it with some options on the table and, you know, how the financials stack up for that in terms of infrastructure projects. It's a good point.
Okay, all right, we'll take one more
that's
here.
That's all going
to
change,
and then
we're going
to come to an end in a moment, but we'll take Jack here.
Hello, my name is Mikhail Metodia from Ott McDonald. Thanks for the lecture, it was very interesting, and I'll bring back the aviation topic. From your global experience, what's your observation about airports? Are they more a follower or are they a driver?
In terms of?
Development, traffic demand, jobs, communities.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's really interesting. I would say, first of all, airports are, it's very, very mixed around the world, and it really depends on the ownership structures as well. Like in New York, they're in public ownership, so that drives certain behaviors. In London, they're under private ownership, that drives another set of behaviors. And, you know, desire for retail revenue and all that kind of stuff. I would just say, in general, there's very poor thinking in the aviation sort of community about how airports connect to the surrounding community. And some of the sort of debacle around the terminal debate and the aviation debate in London has caused all the airports, I think, to rethink, you know, what is their story about what impact they have on the community? They're employing tens of thousands of people. So how are they, somebody's telling me about Gatwick the other day, a lot of the people who work there cycle to work because they can't afford a car or the railway, you know, fares to get there. And then they cycle down this really dangerous A road. But, you know, for Gatwick, they'd never really thought about that. So they're starting to try and think about, like, how do they play a role as a sort of very major employer in the community? And also, you know, things like surface access, how do they affect railway connections, improve railway connections? So I think it's changing, but it's quite slow. Within the footprint of the airport, I would say within transport world, airports are very well advanced. So they're kind of much more advanced thinkers than, say, railway operators. You know, railway stations, they think they're like super forward thinking. If they have a W.H. Smith, you know, it's like, we have a cafe and a news agent. We are totally doing retail here. Whereas in airports, you know, it's much more sophisticated, and the quality of thinking around the passenger experience and all of that kind of stuff is much, much more advanced. So there's a really interesting opportunity there about aviation thinking kind of being brought into the railway space as well. So it can learn from other bits of transport and also teach other bits of transport. That's okay, I can hear you.
So when cities prepare their long-term planning, do they see airport development as something that will drive other developments in the cities, or do they first want to develop the city from inside before increasing the airport?
I think it's very poorly integrated with city planning, I would say, as a general proposition. There's obviously exceptions to that. But both at the macro level, you know, like, okay, the city's going to double in size, so how much aviation capacity do we need? Where do we want it? That's very, somehow just never seems to make it onto the list, A. And B, if they have airports, it's kind of thinking about how can that airport be used to help drive improvements in the surrounding area. Also, you know, for example, I mean, airports like Stansted, Gatwick, Heathrow, rail access is crucial for them. It's totally a key driver of their competitiveness within the London market, where people have choice. So why, you know, they would be prepared to potentially invest in the railway in order to improve the service that they're getting. But that doesn't, you know, that kind of thinking doesn't happen at the city level usually. I mean, London's not unique in that respect. So it's a really interesting opportunity and something I think increasingly airports are going to have to think about, and cities as well.
I'm going to stop. Okay. And I encourage you to sit down while I just thank you and say a few words. I'd just like to round up with a couple of thoughts, really, and then thank Isabel. I think what this tonight's the talk and the discussion that's come subsequently suggest clearly is that planning, be it transport or other aspects of infrastructure in a very large, or indeed in smaller cities, is the complex interweaving of politics and planning and money and what people, the millions of people who use the systems, who make up the political system, themselves want, which is often conflicting, of course. We all want different things within ourselves. We want conflicting things, particularly of transport. I often think, I always use this example of, you know, we all want better transport near our front door, but not too close to our front door. It's the near but not too problem, which I think is indicative of a whole range of ways in which, in cities, almost all government is a matter of reconciling conflict and rationing within a very, very tightly packed geographical area. So we've ranged wide and far this evening over London's recent past and current future, and not only London, other cities, some of the lessons taken from other cities. I strongly support the idea that I'm always intrigued by the wonderful things that are done in smaller cities, but the difficulty of generalising from smaller cities into very large cities, and then the question of what the comparator is for a very large city other than another very large city, when they all have often unique political systems, with everybody thinking it's only we understand us. So the issue of transferability is always a complex one. The river didn't come up, did it? There, the airports and civil aviation did twice. So well done, not mentioning the river. The Deer River, which often gets mentioned. It's a wonderful thing, but not the best means of conveying people, I think it's fair to say. Anyway, on all your behalf, I'd like to thank you all for coming this evening on behalf of LSE Cities. I can advertise the executive masters and other things which are on those documents over there if you'd like to pick one up on the way out. But for everybody else who's here, including our excellent students who are currently on the executive masters in cities, thank you for coming, and particularly thank you to Isabel Dedring for speaking so elegantly this evening.